Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Austin and Jim, welcome. We thought we'd talk about Iran this morning. They've been kicking up dust as they normally do. The Russians seem to be heavy in bed with them right now, and they're proceeding with their nuclear development, and also, more importantly, their developments in missile technology. Where is their missile technology at right now?
It's basically nowhere. Iran has been running this huge scam for the last 10, 20 years, where they pretend that they have a high-tech industry, but they don't. I mean, it's so predictable. They play the same record, you know, same track, as it were, over and over again. They announce a new high-tech weapon, and you can, of course, find this all on the Internet. They apparently aren't aware of how easily they can be unmasked by Google. And you'll see year after year they announce these new high-tech weapons, which are never heard from again. They sort of like disappear. Their missiles are basically technology they bought or bartered, as the case may be, from North Korea with a little help from China. They allegedly at one point got some technical advice from Russia as well. In other words, they have the oil money, and that's where it goes, and that's why most Iranians are angry at their government, because, you know, while the government's wasting all this money on, you know, useless military technology, you know, people are unemployed and not doing so well. So it's effective stuff. I mean, they could probably hit Israel. That's not to say that the Israeli anti-missile system would knock all or at least some of those missiles down. But they are dangerous, but nothing much more than that. I mean, recently they put up Sputnik. They put up a satellite. Yahoo, you know, they did what Russia and the United States did 50 years ago. I'm scared.
Right. Well,
Dan, let me make a comment on that. I'm glad that Jim came back to that. Again, that it is mediocre. It could even be sub-mediocre in its manufacture. We don't know. We suspect it is. We have good reasons to suspect that because that's been their track record in the past. But they've also put money into it, as Jim said. They bought expertise. It is so funny. This is an aside that we can come back to that, to me, that we see the Iranians and the Russians collaborating, because you want to talk about old antagonists. They're old antagonists, but Russians want to make money. The Iranians want to, at least the Mullah regime wants to spend money, and the Russians will sell them technology, perhaps with the idea that the Israelis or the United States will ultimately blow it up before it becomes a threat to everyone in the region and possibly even a boomerang threat to Russia. But that said, I do think, you call it a fear, a risk assessment. It's both. It's also a conclusion that it is that enough of the missiles are good enough. And let's say you get one shot. I think the one shot plays into the hands of being able to, and then maybe two, but a pulse or a volley of some of their missiles. And essentially, I mean, Jim's written this. They're updated, upgraded Scud-type ballistic missiles. Some of them have ranges of 1,800 to 2,000 kilometers. They're working on a version, and I only picked this up from Strategy Page, of course, Dan, that has a longer reach. But if you draw a 2,000-kilometer range fan around, base it in northwestern Iran, you're getting a good swath of at least southeastern Europe. You're certainly able to hit Israel. You're able to, if you decided to do it, threaten Persian Gulf regimes. Use this as another tool if you exploited the Strait of Hormuz scenario. In other words, decide you're going to try to throttle the world's oil lifeline to the Strait of Hormuz. You close it, and then you tossed off some long-range rocket shots at Saudi oil fields and the like. Maybe if you're really aggressive, you add some persistent chemical munition of some agent of some sort to it. These are horrifying scenarios. They, what Jim is going to tell you, they'd be a death knell for the Mullah regime. I think so, but you still have to look at some of these worst cases, because you have some pretty worst cases in the Iranian government. So when we grade the technology as mediocre or sub-mediocre, still you get enough of them, you got a problem if they decide to use them, and you got to be prepared to deal with that problem.
Now,
another thing to keep in mind is the Russians have an enormous amount of self-interest in arming Iran. Because by giving Iran better armaments, whether it's better missiles or anti-aircraft missiles or whatever, Iran becomes more of a threat to the other nations in the Persian Gulf. And heaven forbid, if Iran should get adventurous and try and block, you know, the Straits of Hormuz, Russian oil becomes much more valuable because they're the major exporter outside of the Persian Gulf. And they sure could use the money right now.
So now
they're arming Iran and encouraging it to be more adventuresome, to create crises in the Persian Gulf to make Russian oil more valuable.
Right. Now, speaking of needing more money, Iran needs more money, because isn't it a fact that now that the oil prices have dropped to around $50 a barrel, that it is not as profitable for them right now to pull that oil up out of the ground in Iran?
They're in big trouble. I mean, the embargoes that have been going on for, you know, almost 30 years now, which have kept them from getting industrial goods, industrial materials with which to upgrade their oil facilities. They've gotten some, but not as much as they want. Makes their oil industry less efficient, more expensive to raise the oil. And, of course, they speak of it openly, that the $50 oil is killing them, because the government, because of the corruption of the clergy, basically running it as a petty cash, you know, account for the clergy. I mean, they get first dibs on all the money for whatever reason. And Iranians are getting upset to the point where even the clergy are worried, because if people get upset enough, there'll be a bloody rebellion, even though the clergy in Iran has stayed in power because they have the support of about 20-25% of the population. And from that 20-25%, they recruit, you know, the guard, the royal guard, as it were. And the Basish, various militias and even street gangs to keep the people in line. It sounds a lot like Iraq, you know, when Saddam was running it. It's a minority, in this case a religious minority. Gosh, that was the same case in but anyway,
the same case
that
in a
works
lot of places, Jim.
Exactly. That works until you tick off the majority to the point where they're willing to take the losses and come at you anyway.
Right.
So yeah, follow the money if you want to find out, you know, what's going to blow up next.
Now,
let me make a point on that.
Okay.
Jim's leaped to the point of the horrid speculation. Where is that point in Iran where you have a culturally rich, highly educated, comparatively highly educated public, literate, a public that is aware of the rest of the world? I mean, Farsi is one of the more important internet languages, actually, in terms of posting, and they have the availability of satellite television, radio broadcasts, as well as the internet. Where is that point that this country, the alienated and isolated and victimized majority, 75%, 80%, And we might be comfortable in saying that it could be more than that, because Ayatollah Khatami ran a few years ago. He got 75 or 76% of the vote, and he was supposed to be utterly smashed by the hardliners, and he wasn't. And that was in an open election. Where is that point that they decide to go into the face of the guns by the held by the revolutionary guards and the militias and secret police that Jim described? And if oil prices stay down, the buffer that the corrupt mullahs have against revolution and revolt diminishes, because they've just had enough, because of the cash from the petroleum exports, to keep things just bearable enough. And when does that run out? And when do you see the crackdown that precedes the explosion? We don't know.
Right. Now, the other thing, Jim, that I forgot to talk about while we were on the missile issue was the difficulty of mating a nuclear warhead to a missile. Now, that's a very difficult process, right?
This is when I was in the Army eons ago, back in the 60s, I was involved with warheads on Army missiles. And so I got to know a bit about it. And since then, I've kept up. I mean, I don't talk about it because it's, even this 1960s stuff is classified. It's very complex. In many ways, it's almost as complex as the nuclear weapon itself in terms of the engineering. You have many more systems. I mean, basically, a nuclear weapon is a simpler device, fundamentally, than the warhead design. Because this device, which has to, you remember, it's got to detonate at the right moment. It's got to detonate, period. In other words, the signal's got to go, hey, time to blow up. And it's got to do it at the right place to have the most effect. And it's got to basically accelerate at the speed of sound in seconds, when it's launched, and then come down, 50, 60,000 kilometers an hour? I mean, it's enormous speed. It's several times faster than a bullet travels when it's reentering. It's got to survive all this stress and still work. And the United States and all the, the nuclear powers discovered, much to their chagrin, that it was a much more expensive process to develop this kind of technology than they thought. And indeed, there have been some embarrassing errors in design, which haven't, in some cases, didn't come out for several decades, I guess for good reason. There was one case, for example, in the 1980s, I think it was, where all of the Navy's ICBMs were ineffective because of a unnoticed problem with the warhead, and they had to really fix it quick. And that was kept secret for a long time. And it's probably happened elsewhere. So the thing, bottom line is, just because Iran may soon have a nuclear weapon, they're not likely to have one that'll work in a ballistic missile warhead for maybe a decade, unless, of course, somebody sells them the technology. Now, as far as we know, China still has fairly primitive warhead technology, because the Russians never handed the Chinese any of that sort of, technology. The Russians and the Chinese were on bad terms throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s. Actually, it wasn't until the end of the Cold War before they warmed up. That's only because the Chinese had money and the Russians didn't. And now, I think the story ran today was Russia refused to sell China the Su-33, the naval version, the carrier version of the Su-27, because they're almost certain that the Chinese will simply, the Chinese said, we want to buy two for evaluation purposes. And the Russians said, oh, no. They said this openly, no, because you're just going to reverse engineer it and steal it, which they've already done with the Su-27. The Russians they forced the Chinese to develop their own warheads. Now, that's all top secret stuff, even what we know, the United States government knows, nobody's going to talk about. Because this is a key and largely unpublicized factor. Nobody gives it much coverage, but it's obviously critical.
Right. The real worry with
the Israelis have talked about this, but the Israelis, again, you talk about risk assessment and worst case, they see themselves as target one because Ahmadinejad and other senior Iranian leaders have designated them as target one. They call Israel a one bomb state.
Yeah, and they're worried about chemical. They're worried about chemical warheads right now, but that's something else to keep in mind. Even chemical warheads are, you know, a complex matter because you've got all these. I mean, chemical weapons are fairly sensitive. You know, they're you got to be careful handling them for one thing. Unlike nuclear weapons, which are built like little tanks, a chemical weapon is basically a large. You know, tank in the traditional sense of, you know, liquids. And you want to basically deliver a lot of it because chemical weapons are not the mighty weapon, you know, most people think they are. You need a lot of them to do any real damage. And delivery is even more, precision in delivery is even more essential because basically you need an airburst for a chemical weapon. If you don't get an air burst, you just destroy the weapon when it hits the ground. They destroy the chemicals. And you got to do the air burst just so, because, again, the warhead is coming in faster than a speeding bullet, and that's not good for chemicals, any chemicals, but especially chemical weapons. So the Israelis are worried about something from Iran falling in Israel. And the more immediate version of that is Syria, where they have hundreds of the shorter-range ballistic missiles, the various types of Scuds. And they've actually published some of the planning they've done for that eventuality. They couldn't keep it secret because they had to distribute it to all the municipalities. So it got out, you know, in the media. Their fear is that if the Syrians have workable chemical warheads The Israelis sort of believe they do. Now, they don't go into the details of why they do, but they do. So apparently they got them from the Russians, which is maybe where the Iranians got theirs from because they're very chummy with the Syrians. They could lose as many as 16,000 people, mostly civilians, if the Syrians decided to, launch.
Right. Now,
the Israelis, let me make a couple of comments on this. Jim's exactly right about the airburst delivery of chemical weapons, and everybody understands what that is that it's like a variable time artillery shell, except you're trying to detonate this missile, and it would still work with the types of artillery delivered chemical agents as well, as it is plunging towards the ground, and the warhead detonates, and let's say that it's a VX persistent nerve comes out and you get a shower. It may not be just one tank. There are ways that you could deliver this to in what they call submunitions, bomblets, but then you also then have a multiple triggering issue if you're trying to get all the bomblets to open so that you've got this cloud of essentially pesticide designed to kill humans falling to the ground. There are lots of variables you got to take into account. Local weather conditions. I forget the exact term of it, but essentially it's like splotching. There are places that you're going to miss. Now you're going to incite a great deal of terror. And of course, if you use this against the Israelis, they're likely going to come back. And my bet is an Israeli nuclear weapon will work, and will be delivered. Nevertheless, if you fired again a volley of a dozen, 18 of these missiles, and you get part of the detonation, you've got a huge war on your hands. Here's the other component. Jim was talking about the shorter range shot from Syria. This is something that the Israelis are concerned about, is the shorter range shot from some of these extended range battlefield missiles, essentially frogs, free rockets over ground. It's not, what do they call it, the Fars 5 or something that they've now seen showing up with Hezbollah or potentially even with Hamas.
Well, they have a new family of weapons to replace the frog, like
frogs.
The SS-21 and what have you. Yeah.
Yeah, but they're essentially free rockets over ground. The old Frog 7 was one that I remember we would be told when I was in the 11th Cav that were pointed at us from one of the guards' tank armies that were operating in eastern Germany across the border from us, and unguided battlefield missiles, but you could put a a chemical warhead on them. That's something that gives the Israelis great pause, and it is something that the Iranians have certainly indicated that, it's something they want to keep in their quiver. How much control do they have over Hezbollah? We think they have a lot. Would they make that move? Would Israeli intelligence pick it up before? You'd hope so, but there are a lot of complications to this, and right. And it's something that the mullahs have no issues in delivering the threats. That's part of the threats they do. That's part of their political package.
Well, it seems like the greatest...
Another problem the Iranians and even the Syrians have, well, especially the Iranians, is they have a technical problem in that the intermediate range ballistic missile, the 1,800-kilometer Javi, which they would have to use to hit Israel, that presents more difficult technical problems than the Scud. In other words, because the warhead from an IRBM, a longer-range missile, comes in faster, it makes it more difficult to make a workable warhead, so they have that problem. The other problem they have, and the Syrians have this also, is if you start raining chemical weapons on Israel, you're going to kill a lot of Muslims. You know, 20% of Israeli citizens are Muslim. And, of course, you got Arab Christians, too, which apparently the Muslims don't worry too much about. But you're going to kill, and that's certainly not good PR. I mean, that was the ironic part about the 2006 war in southern Lebanon. Most of those rockets, 4,000 or so rockets that Hezbollah fired across the border, they landed in Arab villages, because most of the Israeli Arab population is in northern Israel. Now, that didn't get too much press outside of Israel, but inside of Israel it was a big deal because the Arabs were yelling and screaming, you know, coming up with more weird stories about, hey, this whole thing is this war was deliberately triggered by Israel because they wanted to get the Hezbollah to wipe out the Arab Israelis. I mean, you know, but that's another story.
The Iranians don't put a lot of truck by Arabs to begin with. I mean, they're...
Well, yeah, but they try and keep that down with regard to Hezbollah because they're all Arabs.
Sure. I'm saying the Iranians look at them as using them just as a tool, you know, and if that's...
Well, that's true, and that's another reason why...
A tool.
And that's another reason why Arabs, even pro-Iranian, Shia Arabs, don't care too much for Iran because they do occasionally drop the veil, as it were, and display this Iranian indifference, you know, to Arabs, or, you know, they basically look down on them. That's what it comes to.
They look down on them ethnically and culturally. I mean, put it this way, it's a Persian snobbery, and the Arabs are aware of it. I mean, it's gone on for...
thousands of years.
2,600 years? Yeah, probably more. You're right.
Well, Jim, we've encountered that in some of our feedback, where we've gotten feedback from some of the Persians, our Iranians, upset because we accidentally mixed them in with one of the Arab populations in a comment or something like that.
That's true. And actually, the ironic thing is, we never mix them in. It's a matter of how you read the article. In other words, if there's any chance of misreading the article to imply that Iranians are anything like Arabs, we get some hate mail,
right,
you know, from Iranian, you know, readers. They're very touchy about that. In fact, one thing I've been hearing from our Iranian correspondents, most of them are, you know, outside of Iran, obviously, is that there's a growing movement in Iran to abandon Islam. You've got to remember, Islam was imposed on them by conquering Arab armies, the only time the Arabs defeated them. And they only did that because the Iranians had knocked themselves out in a series of civil wars before that. So the Iranians, they don't like the Iranian government won't say this, but your average Iranian, you talk about Iranian history, they basically say, yeah, the Arab sucker punched us and left us with this damn Islam. But that sort of attitude is becoming more predominant. Now, people get very attached to their religion they were born into. So you have a lot of Iranians who are still very into Islam. But a lot of them are saying, who needs this crap? It's nothing but trouble. Let's go back to the old days. In fact, that's one reason why a lot of the old Zoroastrian, that was the religion before Islam,
right,
is still practiced as, you know, as basically cultural things, you know, like the Spring Festival, which is going to come around. You're going to pick up some stories about the Iranian lifestyle police cracking down on bonfires and young men jumping over bonfires, which is an old Zoroastrian thing. It was the fire religion. And the only ones left are in India.
No, that's not exactly right.
There are still some in inside Iran, but they have to keep very quiet.
Well, you see this cropping up though in other places in some of the traditions that where you know, Persian cultural effects that spring festival. It's not all the necessarily the Zoroastrianism, but it is. They were Zoroastrians. There's still a long tradition of respect for Zarathustra. That's also
yes.
Sprach Zarathustra. I find this interesting, Jim, that you've gotten this. Some of this feedback from, as you say, some of our Iranian sources on this, but then here's another way to read that, and let me toss this out as some discussion, is that there are a lot of Iranians that are just fed up with this so-called Khomeiniist Islamic revolution. It hadn't brought
exactly.
a revolution, but it's brought poverty. And is this Islam or is this a political front for a bunch of corrupt clerics? Well, it sure looks like it's a political front for a bunch of corrupt clerics.
The attitude I get is they were basically sucker punched by, as one guy put it, we were sucker punched by Islam twice, once in the 7th century and again, you know, in the 1980s. When the mullahs basically hijacked the revolution. The revolution was supposed to bring democracy to Iran.
Yeah.
But the mullahs took over.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. They said, hey, wartime emergency, we're fighting the Iraqis. And they basically slipped in a constitution that wasn't, you know, approved by majority vote that basically gave them the final word on anything political.
Well,
and that's how they've been able to run their little dictatorship. They have the religious council.
That's an interesting read. I'd like to see that. I'd like to look at that particular.
Oh, no, Iranians accept that as, so to speak, gospel. That, you know, the constitution they're now operating under is illegitimate because, A, it gives a bunch of unelected clerics the final word on anything political. In other words, they can basically veto anything Parliament does. They also have to approve people running for Parliament.
Control mechanism.
And then secondly, that constitution was basically snuck in, you know, slipped in by the clerics as a wartime measure. You know, it's like the old communist thing, you know, the dictatorship of the proletariat is temporary. Eventually we'll have true democracy. Well, yeah, when does that ever come?
Well, let me, as we're coming up here on time,
right.
Let me make a statement clear to our strategy page listeners. Jim and I have never confused Iranians, Iranistan, with Arabs. You can go back and look at the original edition of a Quick and Dirty Guide to War and work produced in the 1980s. It's quite clear. Please reserve your hate mail for some other issue, and if it slips in, please make sure it's not a commenter and not coming out of our work. So, I make an ad like that, Dan?
Yeah, you can. Now all you have to worry about is the Sri Lankans that get mad at us every once in a while.
Well, I'll let Jim have that one.
But
God bless America. I don't worry about them.
All right.
I just want to address real quickly is it seems to me like the real threat from Iran is that they like to stir up the pot and that they're basically...
Well, they need that. This is the classic gambit of a dictatorship. When things get too unpleasant internally, they create a foreign enemy. And that's what's kept, you know, Castro in power for 50 years because he's got the Colossus of the North threatening them constantly. I mean, all during the Soviet period, you know, you read, and I learned how to read Russian. I'll never forget my first copy of Pravda I plowed through. It says, my God, half of it's paranoia about, you know, the West is about to attack us. I says, I can't believe this. But, hey, it worked. It kept people, you know, riled up and nervous about, you know, external enemies. And that's the same thing the mullahs are doing. Mullahs are commissars. It's all the same pile of crap.
Right. And it, the problem is when they get funding to
right
some of the... Yeah. And the real problem...
Paranoia.
And that's where if the oil prices go back up, it's going to cause more trouble.
Exactly.
Exactly. All right.